clicked it.
What kind of music did they play?
Okay, call to order the House Committee on Education for the 27th of February. Okay, welcome all back. Hopefully you had a good weekend. Okay, the first thing I would like to do is open up an informational session for the Youth Development Council, Iris Bell and Bill Hansel.
Good afternoon, Chair Doherty, Vice Chair Wilson, and members of the committee. My name is Iris Bell, and I'm the Director of the Youth Development Council. We're here this afternoon to give you an informational hearing on youth re-engagement. And so we'll be going through and giving you a little background on some of the work that we've done and where we are with that. So, just starting off.
Being in the big room, sometimes we can't see Matt over there. So. Yeah.
So just sort of starting off, as you know, the council was established to oversee a unified system that provides services to school-age youth through 24 that supports educational success and career workforce development, and that focuses on crime prevention, reduces high-risk behaviors, and is integrated, measurable, and accountable. So you know those things about our system. Our goals for 2017-19 is to envision that particular concept that we oversee this unified system. So we're really looking at how we can support the legislature's mandate in that way. We're also looking at how we improve quality in terms of youth-serving community-based organizations and helping to support them with program quality in their communities, which is something that we've been looking extensively into doing. We also advocate for, and you will hear more about, the notion of youth re-engagement for disengaged youth. And we are going to be looking more at how we bring together our partners in this system in terms of how to do that. In the bill itself, that we'll talk about a little bit later, actually calls for the development of a task force to really look more succinctly into how we operationalize a youth re-engagement strategy for the state of Oregon so that we can bring our young people, primarily ages 16 to 24, who are not in school and not working, back to our schools and our communities in a very productive manner. So who are these out-of-school youth and what is being said about them? The Center for Law and Social Policy defines an out-of-school youth or a disconnected youth as a person, again, between the ages of 16 to 24 who lacks a high school diploma, is not enrolled in school, and is detached from work. In Oregon, to be counted as a dropout as defined by statute, one must be a student who was enrolled in the current year and who dropped out, or is enrolled in the previous school year but did not attend, is not a high school graduate, has not received a GED certificate, nor have they withdrawn from school. So that's what we're calling out-of-school youth. Now, nationwide, there are about 5.5 million young people who fall into that category. Almost one in every seven, or about 13.8% of the young people between the ages of 16 to 24 in this country are considered out-of-school youth. And these youth, that disconnection itself has a high cost on our communities and our society, with an estimated $26.8 billion alone, and that was in 2013. So we know that there are some negative impacts with respect to what happens to young people when they are disconnected. We know that they fall into our other social services systems, such as our juvenile justice system, our homeless youth systems, our foster youth systems. And so one of the things that we think we have the ability to do in this state is to begin to address and support these young people. So what Bill is going to do is he's going to take you through a look at out-of-school youth specifically in the state of Oregon to give you some background into who these young people are and what's happening to them as we move through this presentation.
For the record, my name is Bill T. Hansel, I just want to, with policy, youth development policy analyst for the Youth Development Council. And Chair Doherty and members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity. You can see in 2015-16 school year, the dropout rate was 3.93%, and that equals 7,140 students. The table below breaks out some student groups within that number. You can see up at the top, homeless youth have an incredibly high rate of 12.48%. It goes by value down from there to span the spectrum at the 3.64%, and that is the only one that is actually lower. White students of this category, that's actually below the state average. So it is definitely underserved populations and marginalized populations that are overrepresented in the dropout rate. And that's something to keep in mind as we move forward. Additionally, moving forward, the dropouts, we want to see they can go back to school, they can complete. So looking at 18 to 24-year-olds, based on the 2014 American Community Survey, these are now young people that do not have a recognized high school equivalency. So over that age spectrum, 6 years, there's 42,506 Oregonians, 18 to 24, that do not have a recognized high school diploma. So this really sets the stage for why re-engagement, and re-engagement is incredibly important, and it's gaining momentum. There's currently a national movement. Very few states have taken up the lead as far as states go. Washington, Colorado are two primary ones. Outside of that, it's largely citywide initiatives. And so we're excited that Oregon as a state is looking at doing this. So nationwide re-engagement and policy has grown in recent years. There's enough going on that they know they can have an evidence-based practice. They know what's effective. And examples range from Boston, Chicago, to smaller cities of I forgot how to pronounce that. Dubuque and Allentown. So there's effective re-engagement focuses on five primary functions: identify and conduct outreach to dropouts, access educational and psychological, social, and other needs, refer to education options, wraparound supports that fit students' needs, so it's not just a one-size-fits-all, support re-enrollment in a best fit option, and provide ongoing support. Portland Public Schools here in Oregon has a robust system. There's multiple pathways. They have a reconnection center, a return to PPS schools and alternative programs, alternative schools, and a community college links and gateway to college style program. Across Oregon, re-engagement typically falls into two informal strategies. One's an open door, which is just kind of you're welcome back if you'd like to come back, and the other is more of an active outreach. That can range anything from an assistant principal or teacher or principal that cares about the student, giving him a call, or in my hometown, going up and getting him out of bed if that was necessary. As I mentioned before, some of the emerging practice, our neighbors to the north, Washington State, have several years of doing this, and theirs is called Open Doors Reengagement. It is formalized in policy now and is actually thriving, but they have removed specifically barriers that hinder reengagement, particularly around accountability at the school level, district level. And then a local program, Colorado Youth for a Change, has pioneered an active re-engagement approach. And they actually are contracted with by school districts and go out and actively look to re-engage youth in like hot spots where dropouts, out-of-school youth are engaged, hanging out. And they foster a relationship and then continue that relationship throughout the process. So it's important to distinguish between a re-enrollment program and re-engagement, because re-engagement speaks to going beyond just re-enrollment, and that's the model that they have established. So why re-engage dropouts? Dropouts consume state and community resources. Applying national estimates to Oregon, even subtracting a $2,000 per student cost would save Oregon $350 million annually, and that's based on those dropout numbers. It's essential for 40-40-20. Obviously, if you have this population that exists in these numbers, it's impossible to reach. And then it provides skilled workers for local economies. And closing what's known as the opportunity gap and the re-engagement idea that we're supporting includes workforce component. And that makes Oregon's model distinct in that it's not just limited to education, so it considers workforce options if that's in the best interest of the youth and local community. There's a need for coordinated re-engagement policy because efforts to increase graduation rates do not necessarily or automatically lead to improvements in dropout rates. Due to the features of the calculation, it's possible to move to increase the graduation rate and at the same time concurrently actually have an increasing dropout rate. This situation actually happened over the last couple years where we saw increases in the graduation rate and increases in dropout rate. And if you're wondering how that can happen, it's partially due to the fact that the graduation rate can improve by pulling students from a completers pool or a five-year graduation cohort into the four-year cohort, so they're never actually touching the youth that have dropped out. And that's how that can occur. So here's a little closer dive into rates, dropout rates. There's a range of a high of 52.46% in Wheeler County. That is so incredibly high. There's got to be something going on. Last year when I presented to this committee, the high was 17% in Crook County, and it's still there. So I'm curious about that 52.46%. Wallowa County is a low at 0.73. I then categorize states by general definitions of southern, central, northeast, southeast, Willamette Valley, just to show kind of a regional idea of those, and you can see them here. And then did a calculation of rates by west and east of the Cascades. And you can see that east of the Cascades actually has a higher dropout rate than west of the Cascades. And wide variations in school district size, locations of state universities and community colleges, and community resources indicate that a regional approach is best suited as a re-engagement strategy. As you'll recall, I mentioned the stuff that Portland Public Schools has going on, some really neat programs that are helping their students. The issue becomes, can that be replicated, say, in Pendleton or Medford or Roseburg? And that all depends on the resources that community has. So what we're looking at is building on the strengths of the local region. And maybe some of the strengths are similar to Portland, some may not be, but the idea is to build on the strengths that exist in those local areas. As we develop a statewide re-engagement policy, a key notion here is alternative accountability, and ESSA has provided some options for those alternative accountability measures. The basic idea is, and interest in a re-engagement system, is that the likely landing pod or landing spot for many re-engaged youth will be some type of alternative school or program. Currently, the alternative schools by our state structure use the same accountability measures as a regular school, even though many of the youth that they serve are already not going to be hitting those indicators by the time, you know, at the time of enrollment in those schools. And as a result, it becomes very difficult to tell an alternative program that's doing well from an alternative program that's not doing so well, or sometimes the term is called warehousing. I think USA Today just did a report on that recently, but it was looking at a way to kind of massage numbers or something like that. Doesn't necessarily happen here, I'm not saying that, but the point is, if you don't have specific measures, you can't tell, because they all look about equal. And so in measuring re-engagement, we need similar type of indicators, because much like the alternative school student, which we hope they become, a four-year graduation metric isn't going to capture anything with that student, mm-hmm. because they've already missed it by having dropped out. So we're looking at ESSA to be able to create some of these, provide a space for some of these options where we can adopt different metrics that allow for that. Using Portland as an example, I came across some stats were provided to me by a Portland Public School District worker, and I think this really speaks to what I'm talking about. The in Portland Public Schools, the graduation rate, four-year graduation rate, is 75%. That's the same as the state, approximately 75%. The Portland Public School four-year completer rate is 81%. The state rate is 78%. And now this is where it gets interesting. At the five-year graduation rate, Portland Public Schools is 83%, and the state average is 78%. So we see a 5% increase there. And then on the five-year completer metric, Portland is at 87%, and the state is at 82%. And the critical thing here is what you measure or what you record, what you indicate, is often viewed as what's important. And here we have a case of, because of the work that Portland Public Schools has put in with their re-engagement system, we see a five-year completion rate that's 5%, that's points higher than the state average. And those are youth that have completed high school in some form or another. Even the graduation rate, the five-year graduation rate, which doesn't include the GEDs and some of the other completer indexes, is 5 percentage points higher. So again, these are students that have earned a high school degree now, 5 percentage points above the state average. And as many of you know, when you go to college or oftentimes on into careers and other places, there is no special, there's not a 5 printed on your high school diploma. It's just a high school diploma. And then I wanted to speak finally to an opportunity the Youth Development Council had at invite of the American Youth Policy Forum to attend a study tour in Denver, Colorado. Denver has also recently got some press because of the way they use school choice. And their school choice is designed to offer options at the alternative school sector of education. And many people equate school choice with white flight or opportunities at the higher end of the educational structure to create, traditional high schools that allow a better education model. Denver has employed one based on legislation that Colorado has supported that allows choice at the alternative school level. And we were fortunate enough to go to 3 different sites that utilized a different model. But one of them was Gateway to College model, which started in Portland, Oregon. And that's where students can enroll, treat the junior college or community college as the high school setting for their high school classes, and then simultaneously enroll in college bearing credits and kind of ease them into that environment while right there on campus. And many times students earn their high school diploma and are just a few credits shy of their associate's degree. So that, again, it was really neat. I'll just point out, this is Nick Mathern with the Gateway to College national program. Tim Boyd with the Oregon Department of Education is a school specialist. Then here we have George Russell, who was superintendent at 4J for many years and is currently a state board member. This is Dr. Chris Betninski, the next person here. He's an assistant principal at Pendleton High School and has been actively involved in alternative education in the northeast part of the state. Some of you might know this guy, Taylor Sharman, representative Doherty at that meeting, as did Rosie Shatkin for Senator Rogan. And then this is Carla Gay with Portland Public Schools. She's the one who provided me the data comparing the Portland Public Schools to state data. And there's me at the end. And at this time, I would
also have Pam Blumenauer.
Yeah, thank you. And I left out Pam because she's here, and I'll segue into her testimony. So thank you for your time.
Thank you. Do you have any questions of this panel before Pam comes up? Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Bill, you talked about a slide, I think it was number 12. Washington State's open door policy, and it talks about removing barriers that hindered school district re-engagement efforts. And I'm not sure if you and I had this conversation or if it was somebody else, but if I could just offer up to the committee, I had a very startling, I guess, incident this last summer. A kid that my husband and I kind of call our own, we just don't have paper on him, said he didn't get his high school diploma. He's same age as my son, so he should have had it a year and a half ago. Didn't get it. And he came to me and he said, I want to get my diploma. So I grabbed him by the hand. We marched down to the high school, got the registrar in there in August, and stood there, and he said, I want to get my diploma. And he was probably about a year shy of having his diploma. And what I found in that incident, I assumed when we walk through the doors that the red carpet would be rolled out. Not for me, but for him. But see, he had been gone long enough, he would hurt the stats, not help the stats. And he wasn't welcomed with open arms, and we were told about the alternative program in this district. We were told about the option at the community college, and I was shocked because I thought, this is going to help the stats. It doesn't. So I pointed that out, that Washington piece, because I think we need to dive down into that. I'm not saying schools are good or bad. I'm saying that should not be the case.
Yes.
When a kid marches in there with somebody and says, I want to re-engage. By the way, he will have his high school diploma the next month because he went to the community college. But talk to us about that a little. Yeah, he's a rock star. Talk about that a little bit, because we are, as a system, creating barriers for these kids to come back, which is just dumb, really dumb.
Chair Doherty and Representative Springer, members of the committee, and that is exactly one of the scenarios that we're hoping this re-engagement type legislation plan will be able to address.
That's
because
right.
In addition to that as well, many districts stop serving students or report to start serving students at 19. Again, the legal age that's allowable by law is to 21. And if you don't have an advocate, such as Representative Springer, behind you, taking you by the hand when you approach that, many times you can leave there with an impression that you've aged out when in fact you're only 19 or 20, and there are and it's a district choice or school choice or something to that effect, but not the law. Also with that, this was you know, your story is recounted here in the Valley, and similar things happen like that all over the state, particularly if you consider small rural schools. You know, I can speak to Northeast Oregon, but, you know, Echo, Helix, some of these schools, that, you know, there's 80 kids in the entire district. There's no alternative program. There is local community college, but if you can get there, you know, and, you know, so that's another thing of, like, what about these students in a school that just doesn't have the supports for them, and the only option is to go back and do the same thing and expect a different result? I've heard that's the definition of insanity, and so that's what we're trying to create is an option that serves students, you know, and this is about students that are motivated and actually want to get their degree and to continue and to participate actively as members in society. So this is not about forcing, you know, students that don't want to. It's about students that, for whatever reason, the single option available to them didn't work. And we want to, you know, create more success stories that you've shared, Representative Springer, that maybe students that are motivated can navigate themselves. So that relationship, however, is critical. And he's lucky to have had you. And if he hadn't, this is part of the system similar to the Youth for a Change in Colorado, that supportive relationship is absolutely critical. The research plays out across the board. And to have a re-engagement support for that can really make a difference.
And I think with you know, anyone that has dropped out or has done this, it just takes one person.
Yeah.
And the kids that have come back, just takes one person to do this. But
one person to discourage.
Yes.
May I add something real quick? Let's just keep in mind this is his story and his success, and it is all about him.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And the one thing, and this is why we've been actually talking about this for about a year, and so one of the bills that you're going to be hearing today deals with specifically what you're talking about, and especially dealing with this on a regional basis, because in Eastern Oregon, you don't the individual schools don't have the resources, but combined they do.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is something that the Youth Development Council has been working on for a long time, and so hopefully after the end of the session, we'll have some legislation that will be able to start to deal with it. And the Washington program is really good. It's been very successful, where literally the money follows the child. And so there are going to be there hopefully would be some resources that would follow the dropout into other forms. And it's been very successful in the state of Washington. So we're going to steal their ideas and put them here. Representative Solman.
Thank you, Chair. So I was curious. Thank you very much for this presentation. I was curious. I serve on the school board in Hillsborough, and one of the trips that I took is I went to the San Juan Far Alamo School District in Texas, where they were looking to address their low graduation rate, high dropout rate. One of the things they did is they found a program. They got the legislators to agree to raise the ADMW to 25. Mm. They also showed up on the doorstep of their students and gathered them, and then gave them opportunities for not just that standard diploma, which I think you also talked about, but also the certification in welding or HVAC and things like that. And I just wonder, are you familiar with what Texas, I didn't see Texas on the list. So I was curious if that, and then are there also, second part, and you don't have to answer that, are there also other studies on, are you doing studies on the why? What are the reasons, the barriers that folks are facing with dropping out?
Chair Doherty, Representative Solomon. I'm somewhat familiar with the Texas project. We had the opportunity to go down to Southern Oregon and talk to some folks in Jackson County who had actually been part of a visit to Texas. Were you?
You're probably with me.
Okay. I was going to say, were you part of that? And they came back very enthusiastic about all the opportunities that they could do to provide supports for these young people. And so part of what we're doing is pulling some of the information from there and utilizing that, and we'll bring that to the table as a resource to guide us as we move through this next year in trying to develop a statewide strategy based on a very regional approach. One of the reasons why the folks down in Jackson County went was because the population of young people and the area and the geography was somewhat the same. And so they were able to go down and see some of the same kinds of issues and concerns based on their community in Southern Oregon with that community down in Texas.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Anything else? Okay, thank you very much. And so the next person is... Okay, and we've got about 10 minutes to finish this up before we go on to the other one, so I just want to keep people's eye on the time. You guys know me. I'm me and the time. So anyway,
thank
you. Make sure
you
identify yourself for the record before you speak.
I'm Pam Blumenthal. I'm Director of Links Programs at Portland Community College. Chair Doherty, members of the committee, thank you for having us here today. And I have a PCC student who's going to speak for a couple minutes after me to tell you his story, which is relevant to this topic. Mm-hmm. I wanted to share why the creation of this task force and this issue particularly is important to the future of Oregon and important to me. As the Director of Links Programs at Portland Community College, I lead four different alternative programs. Two of them are high school focused. Our Links programs provide individualized support that increases student success for underrepresented students. You may be familiar with our Future Connect program, which supports first generation low income college students. But we also have two very effective high school programs. Gateway to College, which Bill mentioned, which has been replicated throughout the country, but started at PCC in 2000. And there's over 40 community colleges that have Gateway to College around the country. We also have a program called Yes to College, which is a GED completion and college program where students complete their GED and continue on to be successful in college. These programs are right here. We've been operating them for over 20 years and have had a great deal of success partnering with local school districts to provide these opportunities. I was very happy to attend the convening with Bill and the rest of the team in Colorado, and we were able to visit a Gateway program, as Bill mentioned, and a GED program very similar to our Yes to College program. As Bill mentioned, Colorado and Washington have prioritized opportunity youth and developed policies and systems to ensure all students have options for completing a secondary credential. In Oregon, we have many other alternative programs that are very successful and doing important work in re-engaging youth who dropped out. But we have to work on creating an environment where re-engagement is a policy and an expectation for all young people. Currently, options for re-engagement are largely based on a student's zip code. In the Portland metro area, the programs that I run contract with 5 school districts. We have many more school districts that could be partners. Weekly, we have students and parents asking about enrolling in our programs, but we must turn them away because they do not live in the district we contract with. So this is a non-issue of capacity. We have the capacity to serve the students, but we do not have, as Chair Doherty mentioned, the money following the student so that we can serve any need. As you mentioned, students coming back and wanting to enroll in school after dropping out, I've had situations with students, unfortunately, who were in their senior year and told even they were 6 credits away from graduating, and they were turning 19 in the summer, and they were not welcome to come back the following year. So they didn't drop out. They were pushed out, and they showed up on our doorstep, and I didn't have a contract with their district to serve them. This is unreasonable. This should not be happening. But unfortunately, these are stories that I've heard more than once. For this reason, I've helped create the Oregon Youth Reengagement Coalition, which has brought people from around the state together, and we are now partnered with the Youth Development Council to move this work forward. As a state, we're losing a great deal And we're letting youth fall through the cracks by not re-engaging them by the age of 25, which we know is pivotal time for young people to either have a degree, a high school diploma, or be positively connected to career. This work is the first step in bringing stakeholders together to develop systems to support all students and to change the trajectory of thousands of youth across Oregon. I'd like to introduce you to Peter, who is a young person who can tell you his story and how dropping out of high school impacted him and where he is today.
Thank you. So, hi, my name is Peter Ravello. I'm actually the assistant clubs coordinator at ASPCC, which is our student government on campus at Sylvania campus at PCC. And I'm getting ready next year to go to PSU. Unfortunately, one of the questions that I know I'm going to face there is, where did you go to school? Where did you go to high school? It's one of the questions that always, the minute I get asked it, gives me a bit of a, I have a bit of a pause. And I think, do I tell them the truth? Do I tell them that I'm a high school dropout? That I dropped out when I was in a when I was in my sophomore year? Do I tell them that, maybe do I lie and say that, well, it's not so much a lie. I went to McNary High School just up in Kaiser. But I also went to a school here in Salem called Salem Technical Preparatory Academy. Unfortunately, I was not able to complete my diploma there. The school was ended. I'm not sure if it's been restarted since, but it was ended the year that I joined it. So I got about a year into it, and I was ready the next year to complete that and get my high school diploma. And our instructors came to us one day and said, "We're so sorry. They've cut our funding. You're going to have to go back to regular high school." Some of the reasons why I left regular high school was because I'm dyslexic dysgraphic, and I know there was a question about why are students leaving high school. I'm dyslexic dysgraphic. It is physically painful for me to do some homework, some schoolwork. It's really hard. And I've worked really hard to overcome that in my college years. But in those times when I was 15, 16 years old, I saw no reason to go back to school. I saw no reason to complete my high school diploma. If I couldn't be at a school that I enjoyed, that was engaging me in ways that I enjoyed, or even just different ways, getting us out of the classroom, we went to an elementary school every week to help students learn to read. And as a dyslexic dysgraphic person, I felt that that was the most beneficial thing that I could do to help my community. So I did that while I was at Salem Tech Prep. The other students that I was with had similar stories. They were not what you would consider achievers, but they were very smart people. I know some of them that have gone on to have similar stories to mine that went to community college, that are even graduated already from university. And I know others that didn't. I know others that went back to high school and didn't graduate. I know others that ended up homeless. So when we're talking about kind of why students are leaving, I was also depressed. I was, when you're going to school and you don't feel that you fit in at all, maybe you have a couple friends, but the classes themselves, the education that you're getting doesn't fit your needs. That's what I was experiencing. And that's kind of why I'm here, what I'm here to say. You mentioned slipping through the cracks. That's exactly what happened. And it happens to too many people like me. And it's part of my position as a student leader to help represent students, and it's part of my kind of personal ethic to help represent my friends. So,
thank you. Great testimony. In fact, this is why we're working on it, is so we don't have kids slip through the cracks. So anyway, thank you. Any questions? Okay, thank you both very much. It's a great program at PCC.
Thank you.
So thank you very much. Okay, anything else with the informational hearing? Because we're running a little over time. Okay. I guess that's it. We thank you very much for this. And so with that, I close the informational hearing on the Youth Development Council and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2419. We're switching things around a little bit. And so we've got about 20 minutes for that one, Representative Parrish. And Alethea will introduce the bill.
Chair Doherty, members of the committee, House Bill 2419 provides funding for TAG students based on the amount per student. Beginning in the 2017-18 school year, Department of Education will distribute from the state school fund $300 per TAG student for school districts with fewer than 75 TAG students and $250 per student for districts with 75 or more TAG students. House Bill 2419 requires the Department of Education to distribute from the state school fund $375 per TAG student beginning July 1st, 2019, and amends the law to require ODE to distribute from the state school fund $500 per TAG student beginning July 1st, 2021. This bill has a subsequent referral to revenue, and there's no fiscal and revenue statement issued at this time.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Chair Doherty, Representative Julie Parrish, House District 37, Westland and Tualatin, here for House Bill 2419. Well, I'm not sure why we're going to revenue since there's no revenue impact. It really should be a ways and means thing, but maybe we'll have to talk to the Speaker about that. Bringing this bill because one of the reasons I ran for office in my very first time, I had mandate from moms and parents in my community who were upset about school funding. Arguably, a lot of us have had that conversation over the years. But really what we see is sort of this decimation of the talented gifted budget. You know, when I got here in 2011, our number of TAG kids that we've identified was higher. We are subsequently doing less and less identification, and we're also spending less and less TAG dollars, while other budgets, pieces of our budget are continuing to increase. So I wanted to let people who are here to talk today, you heard what the bill does. Basically, it starts with a ramping up. It's starting in this school year. Identifies that we have an issue of whenever we have these programs for small schools and having a component to make sure that they can actually stand up a program. I think that's very important. So there's a piece of this with a one-time allocation for small schools to help get TAG programs going because a lot of smaller districts have almost, you know, wholeheartedly abandoned TAG. You might hear from some of the TAG advocates as little as $6 per student in some districts being spent on TAG students. But I did want to put together a document because a lot of times when we have these conversations about school funding, you know, if we just have more money. So I wanted to give you a comparative to other states, that have similar per student or less per student funding than we do, that have a higher four-year cohort graduation rate than we do, and that other than Washington State, our neighbor to the north, identify more TAG students than we do. You look at a state like North Carolina that's identified 12.2% of their students as being TAG, and they spend $431 per student on average. I don't think children in North Carolina are necessarily smarter than kids in Oregon. And so I think that when you look at some of these rates and how much they're spending, it's clearly having an impact on their graduation rates. They all have higher graduation rates than we do. But when you look at our own numbers around TAG, it's very concerning, and particularly for low-income kids and for children of color, that they are not being identified at the rate that I think that they need to be. And to have watched our TAG population come down from as much as almost 42,000 kids identified to this year 37,000 kids identified, at the same time our student population is increasing, I think we are, as a state, doing less and less for these kiddos. So you did hear that the bill ramps up, and every two school years we would increase those dollars a little bit more until in the school year 21 and 22 that we would get to a $500 per student funding. It also reaffirms that districts really do need to have TAG plans. There are districts that don't put a lot of effort into this because, of course, there's no dollars. Other states have TAG administrators. We don't really put a lot of time and effort into developing teachers to be TAG administrators. And then this would also allow districts to work on those TAG plans in concert with other school districts
districts and ESDs, and it would also put an accountability matrix in for how school districts spend the money. So I do have a committee hearing in another committee in just a few minutes, and I want to give proponents of the bill an opportunity to speak. But I feel like this is a population, particularly when you look at, again, percentages for young black children who are not identifying, Latino children who are not identifying, disproportionately identifying Asian students compared to all other ethnic groups. Something's wrong with our TAKE system, and it is not working for kids. And again, when you look at other states with that spend the same type of money on education we do, they're getting this done. And so the question is why. I don't have that answer, but I think that it's merits to having the conversation. You're going to hear from parents today who are very frustrated by this. A TAG identification in this state, and I have one TAG child out of my three, a TAG identification in this state means almost nothing. There are no additional supports and services. And what was also alarming to me is that you do have out of the TAG population, thank you to ODE for getting me the data, about 0.5% of those kids are part of our dropout rate. So with that, I'm going to leave it to others unless there are questions, but I want to give people who traveled here today the opportunity to have some time to speak.
Okay, are there any questions? Okay, thank you very much, Representative Parrish. Okay, we have six people signed up for here, so I'm just going to call, well, I'll call the OTAG people and then the Multnomah people at the same time. So Jessica Beldola, Celia Bakuli, and Adrian. You can have the three of you come up. And we have about 15 minutes for the testimony. And then we'll have the other three from Multnomah County. Okay, thank you.
Chair Doherty and members of the committee. My name is Celia Cooley, and I am the stay-at-home mother of two TAG-identified sons, 16 and 13. My older son just finished multivariable calculus and quantum physics at Willamette University, in addition to his full-time load at South Salem High School. I have been that parent for much of my son's school career to allow him to find his right math level. We made a choice a number of years ago that I would not work outside the home while the kids needed me because their learning needs are so different. We part-time homeschooled my older son in 4th, 5th, and 6th grade to give him the instruction he needed. Then we turned around and part-time homeschooled the younger one in 5th grade. My 13-year-old attends private school for middle school. We have fired the Salem-Keizer School District over the lack of TAG services and advanced math options. We have experienced a range of teachers and professionals, from those who get it and supported my son's learning needs to those who did not understand why they could not be more patient, more mature, and wait for their group quietly, day after day. We have been very fortunate that I can stay home with my kids and that I have a college degree and can homeschool them where needed. There are many children like mine. I have seen the posts on children on social media where parents of gifted kids are thinking of moving to Oregon, and they are told, don't bother. Oregon has the bare minimum. Oregon has the bare minimum of TAG services and doesn't value TAG. What you get without TAG services is under identification, untrained teachers, and demotivated or bratty kids. We should be growing our own doctors, engineers, and bilingual teachers in Oregon. We have a shortage in all these professions, and yet we fail to prepare our brightest kids to succeed. Funding is long overdue for these kids. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. I would be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, thank you. Okay, one of the other two ladies want to testify?
Chair Doherty and members of the committee, my name is Jessica Bedoya. I am a sophomore at South Salem High School. I have a 3.97 grade point average in honors classes at South Salem High School. I was the first runner-up for the OTAG Gifted Scholar Award in Oregon my seventh grade year. I get free lunch at school. I am fluent and read and write both Spanish and English, although Spanish is my first language. I want to be a bilingual lawyer when I grow up. I am one of the 10% Latino TAG-identified kids in Oregon. The percentage of Latino kids in Salem is about 40%, and the percentage is around 20% statewide. At best, Latino kids are identified as gifted at half the rate of others. There is something really wrong with those numbers. I am a bright, hard-working student, but there are many kids who are not TAG-identified that are just as smart or smarter than I am. I didn't do as well as I wanted on the PSAT. Doing really well on an English test is much harder for me. I qualified for TAG on my fifth grade math test. I had been close to TAG qualifying in third and fourth grade as well, but it is really hard to have the level of work you need when your Title I ELL class is far behind the work you can do. I didn't get the instruction I needed to show I was TAG before, but I was gifted. I studied specifically for the fifth grade math test and qualified as TAG that way. The OAKS test isn't available anymore, and that was the best test available for ELL kids to do well on and show that they were TAG. The SBAC requires a lot of English to do well and will miss a lot of kids, especially mathematically talented kids. I suggest that school districts use some of this proposed TAG funding to fund alternative tests to find other Hispanic gifted kids. 10% is a very low number. We also need to do a lot of work in identifying more kids like me in more types of schools that are ready for more advanced work. In my Title I elementary school, very few kids were allowed to go ahead in math. When I got to middle school, I realized that kids that came from wealthy schools were allowed to take advanced math in fifth grade, and they had a bus from school to math class and back. I am glad I am in high school now at a good school with honors programs. We are lucky to live in the South Salem High School District because South is the most rigorous school in the district and kids transfer and take the bus to come here. There were no honors classes available in elementary or middle school, and I was really bored. I am a nice girl, and my Latino culture forbids that I should act out in any way, but I was boring and a waste of time for me and other kids to sit through regular classes. Teachers do need to understand that just because you don't act out doesn't mean you aren't bored and don't need extra challenges, and that extra challenges don't mean extra work, but harder work. Maybe you should be referred to TAG testing even though you don't act like an Anglo TAG student. And maybe you should be given a test where you can excel. I could spend more of this proposed funds to teach teachers what TAG kids act like and how they might act differently coming to other cultures. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. And we have about 5 minutes for the rest of the four, so if you can kind of summarize some of the things you were going to say, we'd appreciate it.
Okay. Yeah. Chair Doherty, members of the committee, I am Adrienne Chalk, and I'm in seventh grade at Crossler Middle School, and I've been in TAG since first grade. TAG is really no different than not being in TAG because you don't do anything. You don't get any extra challenges. Some of my teachers at my school think TAG means just more work, so if you would finish an assignment, they just hand you another assignment to do. But I've never really been challenged, and it's like been hard to come to school every day because I've been so bored in all my classes. Because if you're not really learning anything, then like, what's the point? And having more funding, like for TAG, would be so much cooler because you could actually learn like stuff in your classes and not just be bored and like read a book the whole class because you finished your assignment early. And so, thank you. And if you have any questions, yeah.
Okay, thank you very much for your summary. Yeah. Any questions for this panel? Okay, thank you very much. Excellent job. Okay, so the next three we have Lori McFarland, Jane Chadwick, and Margaret DeLacy. And if you could summarize, because we've got written testimonies, so thank you very much.
Representative Daugherty and members of the committee. I think I'll just read a couple paragraphs then to summarize.
Okay, and just make sure you identify yourself for
the
record.
Yes, I'm Lori McFarlane. I'm from Portland. In his regular kindergarten class, my then five-year-old oldest son languished, acted out, and was disciplined on nearly a daily basis. Fortunately, he had an on-site after-school program, Mad Science, and sat in the second grade classroom whenever he was sent there for a punitive timeout. I checked in with these two teachers to see how he was doing in their classroom since kindergarten was disastrous. In one example, the kindergarten teacher was completely exasperated that he refused to come out from under his desk while that teacher taught class how to count to 20. He was able to count into the tens of thousands by then. In stark contrast, both the second grade teacher and the mad science instructor told me, "My son is 100% engaged, cooperates, and contributes in class." Tragically, teachers can often mistake what they perceive as immaturity, acting out, and uncooperative behavior as an unchallenged and bored, gifted boy. I'll skip a little bit of this, but this is my son's, that's the quintessential tag story, and I hear that today, and I've read testimony, and it's remarkably similar. It's just amazing. After 5 years, we decided to leave public school, and I guess you'd call it dropping out, but what happened was really remarkable, too, in that he excelled in the blended coursework I was able to find for him. He took classes at college. He took classes online. He took classes at a homeschool class center. Basically, he re-engaged with his learning, loved it. And even though in public school he was barely meeting his science, he almost didn't pass science in fourth grade, and this is his passion. In ninth grade, he entered an IB program in physics and excelled at it. And I'll just leave with, he's now 20, decided to forego college for a while he's a software engineer, full software engineer, not an intern, and he's going to do that for 4 years because there's stock options at the end of that. And he's thinking about cybersecurity at MIT 3 years from now. And I guess what I'm saying is that, I urge you to support TAG funding because his TAG plan was a facade. It didn't serve him. It never served him in his first 5 years of school. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Okay, next.
Thank you, Chair Doherty and Representative Parrish. Thank you so much for this bill. Thank you, committee, for the opportunity to testify here today. I'll try not to get emotional. This is just a story of what it's like to be a parent of a talented and gifted child in Portland Public Schools. A child was identified in early kindergarten as TAG. He tested as what is considered to be highly gifted, scoring a 99th percentile in reading, math, and cognitive ability. But there was a big problem. He hated school, hated it. Every day for 2 years, dragging his feet, crying, kicking, screaming, not wanting to go to school. Why haven't I learned anything? Why are you sending me to school? I haven't learned anything all year long, every day. The school tried to differentiate. It didn't work. The whole grade advanced him from kindergarten to second. It didn't work. It didn't help. They tried. As a parent, there is nothing that will stop your heart like hearing these words from your child, a seven-year-old. "Mom, if I kill myself, would you kill yourself too?" This is what this does to these children. Luckily, this child was accepted into Access Academy. I'll kind of skip forward a little bit here. They meet his rate and level in PPS on a daily basis. They hold grade advanced him in math, grade advanced him in math. He's a happier child. He wants to be the first to the bus stop every day. He has friends. He loves his teacher. But guess what? He still hates school because for the first 2 years of Portland Public Schools, what did he learn to do? Hate school. It's taking forever to undo this damage. These kids will not be okay. You can't just ignore them. Please fund this bill. And the rest of the testimony, I think, does a great job of making my other points. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, next.
Chair Doherty and members of the committee, my name is Margaret DeLacy. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Association for Talented and Gifted. You have my written testimony. I'm not going to read any more to you. I just wanted to say that I was in Jane's position when my child was 7. I was here testifying in tears. And since then, the situation has only gotten worse. That child is now in his 30s, and he is not sending his son to school. So I hear a lot about disengagement and about the problems that we all have in sending our kids to school. But we do need to pay some attention to the kids who come to school ready. And we bring our children to school, and like Representative Springer, we discovered that we're not exactly welcome in the school. And our children get that message very, very quickly. This has been going on for an entire generation and a half. These children have gone, my children have gone all the way through school, and they never received any services. We were told every single session that nobody could find enough money for them. And at some point, this has to stop, because we're throwing away a lot of children. So I'm here to answer any questions that you may have now.
Okay, fine, thank you. Are there any questions of the panel? Representative Fernandez.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Quick question regarding revenue. Is your association looking at options for revenue reform so that we can fully fund our education system?
Representative Hernandez, our members are primarily engaged in trying to keep their own children alive in the system. If our personal position was changed, I think we would be able to put more of our time and attention into larger statewide issues.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Representative Pierce.
Thank you. I kind of want to reply to Representative Hernandez a little bit. While the education budget since I've been here has actually increased, the TAG funding in that budget has gone down. So we're actually, as we've made new investments into K-12 education, this particular area is actually seeing subsequently less and less money while the budget has grown. And we can argue how much the budget needs to be, but we're also then seeing the enrollment or the identification of those kids go down as well. And so therein lies the rub, is we have had times where we've had the money and we're still not making those investments.
Okay, thank you. Are there any other questions to the panelists? Okay, thank you very much. Those were the only 6 that we had signed up. Is there anybody else? Okay, thank you very much. So with that, I close the public hearing on House Bill 2261. And I'm before we go on, we might hold over House Bill 2657, because right now we're going to open up a hearing on public hearing on House Bill 2261. Alethea, if you could go through and explain what the bill is.
Yeah, Chair Doherty, members of the committee, House Bill 2261 expands the allowed responsibilities of the Youth Development Council to now include the coordination of statewide services to youth identifying as lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer, or questioning. There are no subsequent referrals for this bill, and there's no fiscal and revenue impact that has been issued.
Okay, thank you.
Chair Doherty, Vice Chair Wilson, and members of the committee, my name is Iris Bell, and I'm the Director of the Youth Development Council, and we want to lay out for you the information that we have to share with you on House Bill 2261, which actually expands the responsibilities of the Youth Development Council to include statewide services and resources to youth who identify as lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer, or questioning. Now, as you know, the council has been engaged in encouraging the continuity and alignment of youth services across several domains. We've looked at homeless youth, we've looked at foster youth, we've looked at youth in the criminal justice system. And as we were looking at those populations, and you do have the policy briefs that we've actually shared with you with respect to those populations, but as we looked at those populations, a particular group of young people stood out. And those young people were our LGBTQ youth, because they impact and they find themselves in all of these systems. They find themselves homeless, they find themselves in foster care, they find themselves in the juvenile justice system, and yet these are some of the most resilient young people that I believe we can actually help to support. So in proposing House Bill 2261, what the council is attempting to do is to look at how we provide these services across the state to these young people. We will have at some point a fiscal, because what we're looking for is the statewide coordination, and we're looking for a particular position to do that coordination to help support these young people and to gather the information that we need in order to look at and identify the kinds of services that are needed and to the kinds of barriers that need to be removed. So I'm here today with Anya Sakino, who's going to take you through these slides very quickly, because I understand we're running out of time, but we wanted to make sure you understood and knew. And I do know we do have some folks who want to testify as well.
We'll have enough time for them to testify.
Okay, very good. So with that, Anya is going to sort of take you through what we have learned about the young people that we're here today to try and support through this particular bill and through the potential to have coordination of services for them.
Thank you, Iris. Chair Dorothy, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Anya Sikin. I'm the Juvenile Crime Prevention Manager for the Youth Development Council. As Iris said, we know we have some information about these young people, and actually we don't know a whole lot. We've looked at over 35 studies and reports on LGBTQ youth population across the nation, and what I'm here to present to you is tidbits of information that we've been able to gather. So the 7% number comes from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. This is their estimation of how many young people ages 12 to 17 actually identify themselves as LGBT in the United States. In Oregon, we have two surveys that give us some kind of information about children who may or may not identify themselves with this population. Again, this information is very limited because the type of kids who get assessed or ask those questions. So the main, well, I shouldn't say the main one. Both surveys, are, they do it in alternating years. So the latest one for Healthy Teen survey was in 2015. Currently, 2017 one is underway. We obviously don't have the information for that. So the survey goes to 8th graders and 11th graders. So on your slide, you'll see that about 12% of 8th graders and 11.3% of 11th graders identify themselves as either lesbian, gay, bisexual, questioning. This particular survey did not have a question about transgender or gender identity in 2015. It is my understanding that they introduced this question in 2017. To give you an idea how many kids that might have been, about 30,000 children were surveyed with this information, both 11th graders and 8th graders. The next survey, that is also a joint work by Oregon Department of Education and Oregon Health Authority, is Oregon Student Wellness Survey. It's slightly different. It covers quite a few more students, 35 counties, 116 public schools, so it's the largest sample. And they do ask a question about gender identity. Oh, sorry, I didn't push the button. Thank you, Iris. But you do have the handout in front of you. My apologies to the audience. With this survey, what we can establish is that at least the 11th grade sample, all these different identities. So I added up the numbers and actually had to check myself twice. So it comes up to 15.8%. That's a significant percentage of the 11th graders. So what do we know about the experiences of youth in schools? They actually are not very good. most days because of the negative attitudes from peers, from teachers, from administrators. Often, children experience different violent acts. Sometimes it's physical violence, sometimes it's verbal harassment, it's teasing, it's physical assault, and it's suicide-related behaviors that are a result of all of the above things. The oldest information that we get comes from national surveys and also research that's been done. If you're interested in actual sources of this information, we have a policy brief and position paper that quotes all of them. We also know that LGBTQ students report high level of victimization at school, and they have high rates of truancy, lower grade points averages, high levels of depression, lower self-esteem, and fewer plans for secondary education. This is directly related to academic success. If you're not feeling safe at school, you're not going to succeed. Or you will succeed, but against the odds. In some national studies, data show that schools administer sanctions to non-heterosexual youth, particularly girls, that are harsher than those administered to heterosexual youth, and are disproportionate to their misbehavior. And this is a study that was done actually in 2016, and it's documenting disparities for LGBT students. This one is a national level.
Okay. We want to make sure we get through all the information, so if you want to summarize some of it, because we have the presentation. Great information.
So there are quite a few other numbers. You will go through them. This is from the National School Climate Survey. The numbers may actually, they go together. It's not different that much from what we see on the sample in Oregon from what people see on a national level. The school climate survey that showed that the highest victimization rates for everybody. Now, this one is a striking. In all the lack of information that we have, even with the small one that we know, we cannot really disseminate between the groups because it's not specifically done for the most part to a particular group within the LGBT community. However, the National Transgender Discrimination Survey surveyed a large sample of people, and the numbers are staggering here. You will see that 40% of people contemplated suicide, and 47 were sexually assaulted at some point. And for their experiences during school years, 54 reported being verbally harassed while in school, 24 were physically attacked, and 13 sexually assaulted. Now, Oregon Department of Education issued over a year ago, just about a year ago, Oregon Department of Education issued a guidance to school district on creating a safe and supportive school environment for transgender students. Mind you, transgender students' rights are supported by civil rights, Title IX Federal Education Amendment to the regulations under the law. And additionally, they're protected by Oregon law. Just a few days ago, Governor Brown issued a statement that she stands by the Oregon Department of Education, which remains committed to ensuring all students are provided education in the state. That was in response to a new guidance that was issued by U.S. Department of Education and U.S. Department of Justice. Now, some things are being done in Oregon. The Oregon News Authority has a suicide prevention plan that has a specific chapter addressing the needs of the LGBT community. And by the way, youth suicide is the second leading death for children in the state of Oregon. And again, while LGBT youth are high risk for suicide, within that group, there are subgroups that are more vulnerable. Those are the homeless kids, runaway kids, kids in foster care, and kids involved in the justice system. Child welfare, children get abused at home, they become part of the system, they get re-traumatized by the system, sometimes for the lack of understanding of their needs. They become homeless. There are some studies from New York City that are done on group homes. You can see the percentages as well. They're staggering. Homelessness in the state, the country, they estimated about 1.6 million youth experience homelessness, and about 40% of these young people are identifying themselves as LGBT, and that's pretty consistent across different states. And if you would consider that according to the same to the Centers of Disease Control, there's an estimation of 7% of youth identify themselves as LGBT in general population, 40% in homeless youth population. That's quite disproportionate. And again, there are various reasons why kids become homeless. The family rejection could be one of them, and aging out of foster care, poverty, abuse at home. There's social stigma that is associated with LGBT kids that would make it, that would increase the risk of substance use, homelessness, school dropout, and push out depression and suicidality. So it's not unlikely for kids to end up in juvenile justice system when every other system fails. Usually kids get picked up for nonviolent crimes, or we would call them survival in the street crimes. Just basic needs to eat, to find a place to sleep. What is being done?
If you could summarize that, because we don't want to, we want to make sure that the folks that are here to testify will
so
have
the,
an opportunity.
Our message is that although there are several attempts by several state agencies to improve our services to LGBTQ kids in the state, it's not nearly enough. It's not coordinated. And we would love to have the opportunity to help.
So Chair Doherty and Chair Wilson and members of the committee, that is indeed what we are trying to propose to do. We are proposing that we look at statewide coordination of services and supports to LGBTQ youth. This is a population of young people who need our support and our attention. As you look at the data and you see what is happening here, I think it is incumbent upon all of us to support these young people and to help them become healthy, productive members of our society. And at the same time, to ensure that we don't continue to see as high a suicide rate among these young people. This is a responsibility that we have, and we really certainly must take a look at this and begin to look at how we help to support and coordinate services for this population. So thank you, and I think we have some people here who want to speak. Oh, I'm sorry.
Thank you. Why don't we have a couple of quick questions? Representative Solomon and Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Chair. I appreciate you mentioning about the coordination part, because I wonder with a lot of the conversations today we've been having with the school-based health centers that have been working on a lot of this work as well. So I appreciate trying to come together instead of every organization trying to reinvent the wheel of providing that information. But you had mentioned, did you mention three tests? Did you mention three different questionnaire surveys that are taken?
There are two in the state of Oregon. One is administered in odd years and the other in even. One is called Healthy Kids.
Mm-hmm.
Healthy Teen Survey, and the other one is Student Wellness.
Okay. And then there was the one that was the climate.
But that one is a national one.
There's
School Climate Survey.
So there is, okay. Mm-hmm. And how often is the national climate?
Every two years.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A question for Ms. Bell. What does the actual act of coordinating statewide services look like? How is it done?
Chair Doherty, Representative Wilson, members of the committee. It is basically just what we're sort of saying here. When we take a look at the state agencies and the services that are being provided statewide, there's not a coordinated effort to say, okay, what is this population? What are their needs? How do we identify the barriers? It's not that they're not doing that, but they're doing it within a siloed approach with respect to their discipline. So you have the Oregon Health Authority looking at various things. You have DHS looking at various various things. You have all of the different agencies. And what we're saying is, and what our mandate is to say, we need to take a look at how we have continuity and alignment of these services for this particular population across the state so that we all know how we're coming together to provide the resources for the for these young people and how we're coming together to advocate for them as well. So that's what we kind of basically mean. We need some coordination. And with that coordination, it means that we need an individual who can look at and begin to look at the data, the research, look at what's happening in our communities and towns across the state, and come back to you with a report that says, here's what's happening and here's what's needed. And so that's what the council has traditionally done in the past. We come back to you and we give you the data, the information, and we say, here's what we found, here's what's needed, here's the kind of resource that needs to follow these young people. And so that's what we are proposing to do with House Bill 2261, is to bring you back the information that says, here's what this young this group of young people needs in terms of this population.
Thank you. Okay, any other questions? Okay, thank you so very much. Mm-hmm. Okay, and with that, we will bring up, and would you have to bring a chair with you? How about Dwin, Fry, Yosha, and Cameron?
There's one right here. Right here. Okay. Unless it's attached to the desk.
We're not going to make you dismantle the furniture, so you can justify it. Okay, thank you. If you make sure you identify yourselves for the record. So, right. Who's going to go first?
I'm Dwin Baird. Do I need to use the microphone?
Yes, you can speak of that. But you don't have to get real close. That's perfect.
Okay. I'm Dwin Baird. I'm a senior at the Metropolitan Learning Center. That's a kindergarten through 12th grade school in Portland, Oregon. And I'll be speaking first.
Go ahead. Yes.
All right. So this morning, we all drove down from Portland together. That was about an hour's drive. And so, of course, when we got here, a few of us had to use the restroom. And we all just sort of knew. We knew. And so I looked at my watch, and I checked what time it was. It was 2:14. We asked, I believe, four separate people, and we walked around up and down stairs from one side of the building to the other, and we found one gender-inclusive bathroom in this whole building 24 minutes later.
Find one on the second floor in the house.
Yeah. That was it, I believe. Yeah. And my point here is going to be a point that I'm sure you've all heard before, made in many different contexts. Representation matters. Support really matters. Because as transgender people, several of us are transgender, we come into a government building, a building that is supposed to be as the government is, by the people, for the people. And we find that we are not represented here. We do not feel welcome here. And so representation really does matter, because I happen to be very lucky in that when I was in seventh grade, I had a teacher, a wonderful woman, Pat Robertson. She was openly lesbian, and she introduced me to the idea of using gender-neutral pronouns, which I use for myself. I use they, them, or he, him pronouns because I'm transgender. And not only did she introduce me to the pronouns, but she introduced me to the reality that queer and trans people are here. We're here among you. And like, we're here whether you see us or not, and we need to be supported. And when so many students are being pushed out of schools because they don't feel welcome and don't feel safe in schools because those schools are not supporting them. I happen to be lucky enough to have had a representation of a queer identity early on in my educational life, and that changed everything for me. That made a huge difference in my life and in my ability to accept myself and my confidence to come out later on. And just last year, I had the immense pleasure of being able to be that representation and that support for a young kindergartner who was coming out to his entire class as transgender. A kindergartner, a 5-year-old, who felt safe enough in his environment to come out because he had representation there. But that representation is not a part of this system. It's not a part of the school system. It is a coincidence of the people who happen to be in his community, because it's a very small community, a very queer and trans inclusive community. We do have openly queer and trans teachers. We have openly queer and trans students everywhere, and we're loud and proud about it. And so this student felt safe to be himself. The teacher
Because I want everybody to have an opportunity.
All right. So. This is my end point, actually.
Yes, thank you.
The teacher did not feel confident enough in her ability to help facilitate that kid's coming out to the students and to the parents of those kindergartners in the class, because she did not feel she had the training or the experience. And so she went to me for help, because I have the experience, the personal experience for that. And so my point is that representation and support really matter, but they need resources. And, well, we need those resources to feel safe existing.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. Okay, next. Okay, who's next?
Hello, my name is Fire. I identify as a Two-Spirit. Two-Spirit is a gender recognized within the Native community, I being from Ogallala Lakota Sioux Tribe. And it's basically where we embody both male and female within ourselves and recognize it. So that's what, and I do use they, them pronouns. So I do have a very interesting story. So I was in high school. I knew since I was little that I was definitely not hetero or straight, whatever. So I kept to myself mostly about it. I decided to come out during my senior year, then got kicked out. I surprisingly still managed to graduate. Then I came across this woman. Her name is Janice. She's the founder of Chick Tech. And very much like Representative Springer, she took me in as one of her own kids. She has a daughter, and her name is Caitlin. She's 9 years old. And, well, Caitlin, I taught her how to use they, them pronouns, and so did her mom. And I just think that it's important that we fund teachers or, like, teach teachers how to teach the little kids how to use not only he, him, she, her, but also to use they, them pronouns, because it is super important. I do, I personally would appreciate it if they did that, because I am very sensitive about they, them pronouns, and I appreciate that people respect them. So, yeah.
Thank you very much. Great job. Okay, next.
Okay.
You're doing a good job.
My name's Yosha, and I use she, her, and they, them pronouns, and I am also a senior at MLC, which is the K-12 school in Portland. I previously actually went to a school that was super not accepting of being queer, and I almost dropped out of school and then ended up going to MLC, and MLC just is, like, way more welcoming, but there's still, like, issues within that, and because I'm in Portland, I, like, am able to get these resources where I can teach myself about the community and, like, different terminology to use when talking about being queer. And often as youth, we have to teach our teachers, and we have to teach our peers, and we have to teach other youth about the terminology and the struggles of being LGBTQ, which we shouldn't have to do because we already have to go through the labor of teaching ourselves that, and, like, finding our own resources outside of school where we should be being told our resources and we should be being supported and, like, finding these resources. And in fact, this morning I was at school and I went into a classroom and ended up, I was with fourth graders, and we were trying to have them go around and say their names and pronouns, but they didn't understand what pronouns were, so then we had to teach them, and the teacher was trying to explain it to them, but, like, didn't know how to teach them that. And so I really think that the state needs to find ways to step up and support teachers and adults so that the teachers can learn how to teach their students the terminology about pronouns and different LGBTQ issues, so that we as youth no longer have to carry that labor of teaching our teachers and our peers. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm going to close this off. My name is Cameron Gustafson. I use he, him, and they, them pronouns.
I am a graduated student of an alternative high school, Fir Ridge campus off of David Douglas High School in Portland. We wanted to recognize that we do have programs and resources in Portland that are really awesome for queer youth. Right now, a lot of us are on programming for Oregon Queer Youth Summit for Queer Rock Camp, and I'm part of a group called Queer to Queer that is just a after school but not at school youth program at Matt Dishman Community Center. I'm a part of a lot of intersections with, I was homeless throughout high school.
Sit back just a bit.
Absolutely. I'm a theater kid. I was homeless throughout high school for a lot of it. I went to 6 or 7 different high schools and moved 32 times throughout my life. I never got a comprehensive sex education that included anybody that was like me, because teachers just didn't want to say the wrong thing. And though I have these cool things that I get to do in Portland, I did have to go and move to McMinnville after high school because I was homeless. And that was where my next resource was. Moving out of Portland, the big city, I lost all my queer resources. There was a small little queer get-together group in a church that was very not informed, and their high school had their first year of letting a trans person into their program called Mr. Mac High, and it was cool, but I still heard from that person and many other people that went to McMinnville High School that they hadn't heard of any of the resources that I had gotten. I also teach a GSA at Ron Russell Middle School in Portland, and the reason I teach that is because there's nobody else that can there.
And GSA is?
GSA is a Gay Straight Alliance. What we call it is a pride club because we like to stay away from Gay Straight Alliance because it should be more open than that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any questions?
Yeah.
Do you have any questions, this panel?
Just a comment.
Representative Hernandez.
Thank you all for coming here today and sharing your stories. Very courageous of you. My hope for the Youth Development Council is that not only does this position exist, and hopefully it's somebody from the community that does this work, but that that the young people that we're trying to impact actually have a place in the decision-making and solutions in a way that enhances their capacity so that we either compensate them for their solutions like we do other professionals, but that we're going to find the best solutions amongst you all rather than us looking at that data and trying to come up with solutions for communities outside of our own identities. So thank you for being here.
Thank you very much.
Any other comments?
Thank you very much. You did a great job. And hopefully next time you come down, you know where you're going to go. You won't get lost. Okay, next we have on the list is Chris Vogel, Nancy Haig, and Kimberly McCullen. Thank you very much. And again, we've got about 10 minutes, so. Thank you.
Chair Daugherty, members of the committee, my name is Chris Vogel. I'm the Education Policy Coordinator for the League of Women Voters of Oregon. We follow everything from early learning, preschool, through higher ed. In the interest of time, you have our written testimony. We support this bill.
Okay. Thank you very much. I guess you said it all.
Chair Daugherty, members of the committee, my name is Kimberly McCullough. I'm here on behalf of the ACLU of Oregon. I also have comments, testimony that I submitted on the record, so you can read that. But I would just like to say that I'm just incredibly impressed with the young people who just came up and spoke to you. Their bravery and courage is astounding, and I think it's extremely important for us as we age and become older to continue to look to young people for all that they can teach us, because they can teach us so much. you know, the ACLU of Oregon is dedicated to supporting our LGBT community, and particularly because of the challenges that youth face. This community needs our help in order to thrive and grow in Oregon, and their lives are literally on the line in many cases. So we really appreciate the work that the Youth Development Council is doing and fully support this coordinator position. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Hi, Chair Doherty, members of the committee. My name is Nancy Hawk, and I'm the co-director of Basic Rights Oregon, and we're here today in support of this bill. And Basic Rights Oregon ensures that all lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer Oregonians experience equality. And as you've heard today so eloquently from the youth here and from the Oregon Youth Development Council, the need for LGBTQ youth is immense. And I think in Oregon, the problem of youth houselessness is even worse than the national statistics that were shared. 20% identify as LGBTQ. And of course, LGBTQ youth experiencing houselessness are more likely to experience victimization and mental health issues. And transgender youth also face many unique barriers. And earlier you saw some results from the U.S. Transgender Survey. We will soon have Oregon-specific results, but more than 27,000 people responded nationally, which is actually a huge survey. And you already saw some statistics. One that was up there but we didn't get to say is that 17% face such severe mistreatment as a transgender person that they left a K-12 school. And given our worries and needs around high school graduation rates in our state, I think it's incredibly important that we pay attention to that. And fortunately, here in Oregon, we are taking steps to address barriers for transgender youth. And the Oregon Department of Education released very good guidelines in May of last year on how to treat and protect transgender youth. And Basic Rights Oregon is working with Oregon Youth Development Council right now to provide trans inclusion training and resources to school districts across the state. And we're very proud to be working with them. And we very much support this coordinator position and support 2261. So thank you for having us here today.
Okay, thank you very much. Any questions for this panel? Okay, thank you very much. That's all that we had on the list. Do we have anyone else signed up for a House Bill 2261? Okay, with that, we'll close the public hearing on 2261. Now, we were going to carry over, because we don't have time, the next one, but we did have some people signed up. And so, we're not quite sure how many are out of state and that kind of thing, but if you can't come back, maybe we can have like 2 minutes of testimony, and then we're going to carry over the bill. Okay? If I don't hear from any of you, I'm going to carry over House Bill 2657. Going once, going twice? Okay. So I will carry over House Bill 2651 until Wednesday, March 1st, 2007, for a public hearing. 2657.
Oh, wait, it's 2651. Sorry. That's wrong.
Okay. Go back to 2651. We'll keep the sign-up sheet and hope that we can hear your testimony. If not, there's written testimony, and we'll be accepting written testimony online until Wednesday at 5 o'clock. So, any questions? Okay, so with that, we close the House Education Committee. Thank you very much. With that, we close the House Education Committee. Thank you very much.